Welcome to a new season of Awaken to Reggio. This is Sandy Lanes, your host. Thank you to all my listeners. Please keep writing and letting me know what connects with you. Our first episode will be a little different this season. Some of my listeners have suggested that I share my journey with the approach. Today, the host becomes the guest. I am thrilled to have my friend, colleague, and thinking partner, Lisa Plotkin, asking the questions as I reveal how I became Awakened to Reggio.
Hi, I am Lisa Plotkin in Richmond, Virginia, an early childhood professional development facilitator. Honored to be here today with you. I have a few words to share about Sandy Lanes. I met Sandy a few years ago as a colleague in the early childhood field, and she quickly became a dear friend and mentor to me. Her experience and her ever-present heart allow her to hone in exactly on what a person is trying to communicate, no matter their age. Sandy Lanes is an educational consultant and thinking partner, working with many schools locally and nationally. Until 2019, she was the curriculum director pedagogista at the Bender Jewish Community Center Preschool in Rockville, Maryland, for 13 years, which she helped to transform from a traditional preschool to a Reggio-inspired program. Over the past 25 years, Sandy has keynoted and presented at many conferences and preschools. She has served on the steering committee of the DC Reggio Alliance. So here we are. Hi, Sandy.
Wow, this is really flipping the script a little bit.
I have some questions. First, just as you ask everybody on your podcast, what is your connection to the Reggio Emilia approach?
One thing I will start by saying is that, as you know, I am a collector of mentors and thinking partners, and you're one of them. And I think that that is a disposition that really weaves perfectly into studying an approach like this. I guess I could go back to a million years ago when I went to the University of Maryland, got my undergraduate and graduate degrees there, and it was an incredible early childhood program at the time, really deeply rooted in constructivist thinking. While I didn't know about the Reggio approach at that point, I think I was being primed to be ready for my learning in that. I taught Head Start when I was younger in a public school. And the amazing thing was, this public school was run by a principal. Her name was Joanne Busalaki, who was progressive, pretty unusual for public school. She was this progressive person who was thinking about play and literacy across elementary school. And I think of it as being so interesting because in so many ways in early childhood, schools are kind of pushing down an elementary school curriculum to early childhood. But instead, she was saying, what can we learn in elementary school from early childhood? I had a very play-based classroom, but also rooted in listening to the children. Many of my children didn't speak English coming in. And so language was so much a part of it, and figuring out how to have dialogue in lots of different ways and not just through the English language. I was looking for a preschool for my own children. One of my children ended up at the JCC preschool here right outside of Washington, D.C. in Rockville, Maryland. And a number of years later, I went back to them and said, I think you should hire me. And they did. I became what they called at the time the curriculum director there. I had already come in with sort of this thinking, this disposition of taking risks, learning constantly, having a pretty strong image of the child as brilliant, knowing things. But even more so, I walked in and eventually worked with a director, Ora Cohen Rosenfeld, who is a model for lifelong learning. And I think of her as a guide through the forest. She was pulling aside all the vines that allowed us to like walk together in this kind of new way of thinking. So together we created a vision. We recreated it every day, it seemed. At the time, I felt like we captured lightning in a bottle with the teachers that we had there. And we grew in this approach together. These were teachers who wanted to walk with us. They asked for more meetings instead of fewer meetings. I know it's mind-blowing. They were interested in thinking together, and they taught me so much. And together, we became okay with the not knowing. And one of my teachers, Jesse, always used to say, I've become comfortable being uncomfortable. And to me, I feel like that represents so much of the disposition of a Reggio-inspired teacher. In this area, we were really fortunate to have Mara Beer, who led at the Board of Jewish Education. She led all the Jewish preschools in this region to think in new ways. And she had been studying the Reggio approach. I'm getting there, see? She had really connected to it through Dr. Naama Zoran, who I hope you've heard on my podcast before. Both of them are mentors for me. When we studied with Naama, she made us question everything. She made my head hurt so much in the best way. She and Mara organized for our community trips to Reggio Emilia. And this was really a place that I felt like I was at home when I saw the way that the educators were with the children. We also took every opportunity to go visit schools like St. John's and the Syart Center in Pittsburgh, St. John's here in DC, and really pushed ourselves to read and study. If I were to say to a teacher, who would ask me, how do you become more inspired by the Reggio approach, or how do you study it? It's really seeking constantly, seeking resources, seeking experts, seeking mentors, seeking coaches. I joined the DC Reggio Emilia Alliance. Shout out to Jen Azzariti, also I interviewed on this podcast, who started it for this DC area. She was really one of the first studio teachers at Telaristas in this country. Lastly, I will say that one of the most impactful learning experiences in this approach for us as a school was having visitors come to our school. It asked us to do what the people of Reggio ask all of us to do, which is to really study who we were, to try to understand our own identity, our own context. And it really had us taking a mirror on our place. So when people would come beforehand, as we prepared for the visit, we really needed to walk around and look around and ask ourselves questions about our day and our environment and our interactions, how we were with the children, with each other. And it required us to look where we had been and where we were and where we were going, and also to be very vulnerable. We shared the truth, the difficulty, the challenge. This wasn't easy. It really wasn't. We made a million mistakes, the mistakes are what I love, really. And we didn't get as far as we wanted to go in a lot of areas, but we were always thinking, and to explain our thinking to others really was for us. That was maybe that metacognitive, what allowed us to be more insightful about our own study.
I am just so in love with listening to your story. I heard a lot of comments that you made that pinpoint your own Reggio inspiration journey have to do with self-awareness and thinking and learning about ourselves, our context, our own program, and just stepping back from taking things personally. As we move forward, I would love to hear your thoughts about how to help somebody become a little bit more able to learn about themselves without feeling hurt by constructive feedback.
I do think that that is one of the more beautiful aspects of the educators in Reggio Emilia. They question themselves all the time. They have been around since, you know, after World War II, they came to be as a social movement to try to figure out how to have a generation coming after this destruction that would stand up for justice and that would not just follow a charismatic leader blindly. They thought we need to create schools, which is what they did along with Loris Malaguzzi. And they have never rested on their laurels. They have never said, you know what, we've got this. They're constantly changing and moving and questioning. One time I had heard from one of the longtime educators from Reggio Emilia. She had come here, Marina Mori, and she had come to speak to the pedagogical leaders in our community. So when she came to this area, we walked around a preschool with her. And we didn't understand her because she only spoke Italian, but we kind of followed her, trying to understand what she was saying with her eyes. We watched her look at the experiences that were provided or offered for the children in the school. I thought, boy, what a brave school anyway, that they would feel comfortable being looked at by one of the foremost thinkers in this approach. And afterwards, when we sat down, she had an interpreter. It was Naama who was interpreting because Naama learned Italian. She started to say to us that she had seen in one classroom clay on a table and that children had mallets and were just simply banging on the clay. And she felt that it didn't really speak to the, that experience didn't really speak to the language of clay, which is used when trying to represent something in three dimensions. So it's not just simply something to bang on or flatten. It really has a purpose. She told this whole thing, and then she looked up at us, and in English, she yelled, "Why? Why?" And I will carry that why with me for the rest of my life, that any room that I walk into, I just want to say, like, why? Just not in a critical way, but in an intentionality way. Like, what was the thinking that went on that took you to this? Simonetta Cittadini, who I had interviewed for the podcast, she said that when Amelia Gambetti came into her school and asked that question, that they ended up putting up signs around the school that said why. And so that's something to think about.
A lot to think about.
Yeah.
I also want to scoot back to what you said with the first question. And you said that you told your former employer, I think you should hire me. And I just want to note to anybody, if Sandy ever comes to you and says, I think you should hire me, drop everything and you hire Sandy. Sandy, can you tell us what have been some of the biggest growing moments in your journey as an educator and pedagogical consultant?
There have been so many. So many. And I'm still thinking and growing and finding new things out all the time. This teacher the other day said to me, I've been doing this for many, many years, but I'm new every day, which I just thought was so beautiful. One thing that I think jumps out at me is the idea of the importance of ownership in the process, that every person involved in the work in a school, the children, the families, the educators, all have to work in tandem. We're all partners. We're all equal in the work. And I think about this idea of both children and adults as active participants, not just receivers of activities, but participants in designing the work of the classroom. In a more traditional classroom, children walk in every day and the teacher says, here's what we're doing today. What we really were working towards was thinking about how could our children walk in every day knowing that they're working on something, motivated to keep working on something, trying to figure out something when they came in, and working together on it. So there's continuity. It wasn't just waiting passively for the teacher to say, here's what we're going to do today. I'll give you an example of that idea of ownership. In a three-year-old classroom in our school, the teachers had put up a family board, you know, photos of the family. And it's common in a lot of preschool classrooms to have photos of each family up. But unlike most years, this group of children literally sat in front of that family board much of the day. And it was the source of so much of their dialogue, their conversations. And when that happens, that importance is shown, that that's what's important to the children. It's time to move closer, lean in and listen. And they were saying things like, I know everybody on this board, all the people. And Avery would say, I know Abby's mommy and daddy. And Amalia said, and you know my mommy and daddy, right? And Avery said, yes, I know everybody. Now, this wasn't even true that they knew everybody, but there. But we started as educators to ask ourselves questions, our research questions. And what we wanted to know is, what does it mean to know somebody? What does it mean for these children to know somebody? And then also we thought about the photos. We thought about how can photos be used to let people know us in a deeper way. But we were also thinking about this idea of ownership. I'm getting back to what I was talking about. And we thought about how could these children have ownership over this idea, this space, this photo space. And what we ended up doing was offering to the children the opportunity to curate their own family boards. There were so many problems that came up in that. First of all, the families were so amazing. They were sending in billions of photos, but you couldn't fit all of them on the board, which was wonderful because it's those problems that we love. The children had to think, what do? I have all these photos. And it kind of started answering the question because they wanted to represent themselves through these photos and had to think, what photos would represent me best? And that would be part of their dialogues as well. So they would be together thinking about, should I put up this one? Should I put up that one? Ethan said, I have a push pin to put on Emily's pacifier, his sister's pacifier. She needs it sometime. And I think he wanted to show something important about his family. There were things that came up that were what they might refer to as knots, problems, things that sort of emerged that we weren't expecting. And that is the beauty of a lot of this is we weren't looking for the expected. We were really looking for the unexpected. That would be another one of those things that I learned along the way, that in more traditional classrooms, teachers set up for the expected. I want children to match these colors or whatever it would be in a more traditional classroom. In a Reggio-inspired classroom, in a classroom where relationships and thinking are at the heart of what is happening, we're looking for the unexpected. That makes it a really exciting approach. It's so much more interesting, really, than just getting the answer that you hoped to get and planned for, that teacher agenda. Some of the problems that came up, Maya said, Abby, your pictures covered mine. And Abby said, okay, I'll move mine over here. So they had to be thinking about space. And what is it when we talk about, some teachers in more traditional settings talk about sharing all the time, but children learn how to do those things when they are given trust and they're working on something that is important to them.
This example is so authentic for the reality of the children. And so often, like you're saying, we're creating and crafting something in maybe a more traditional space. And the children are bringing these types of experiences to the setting all the time. And as you were saying, it's our job to, as Ann Pelo said, joining our attention to the attention of the children.
Yes, that it is our role to listen for the theories of the children, the theories that they're offering us all day, all the time, that we can so easily miss. They understand things about the world. And that's what we are here to understand ourselves. So it's that shift of, I'm here to teach the children something, a shift to, what have the children taught me and how can I respond to that? So living in that place as much as possible. I think that you are getting the idea about this process that happened in the class, that the children, these three-year-olds, truly took ownership over. This went on for a year and there were so many branches and interesting things that came up and questions that we thought about in our teacher meetings together. And then we offered new ways of being to the children, like Photoshop and ways that they could literally hone in, zoom in on what they wanted to show about themselves and what represented them. So powerful. At the same time that we were thinking about the ownership of children, I had to really think about, what does it mean to be a pedagogical leader in a school? And the idea, the same idea that we wanted our teachers, our educators, to feel ownership over these processes, which is also really a shift from a very traditional way of being. I think teachers often are used to somebody coming in and telling them something in the meeting. They wait for that. It's very passive. But I had to start really learning to constrict myself in a way, to really become part of the thinkers and not just the one that was doing all the planning and that sort of thing. And thank goodness I was surrounded by people that really picked up on this. And Ora and I, while we really, I think, as Nama says, held the compass, we thought about the vision. We brought everybody into thinking about the vision with us. And so that was, I think, one of the biggest things that over time I really came to understand in a new way. In our meetings, I remember the feeling of saying to myself, let there be some silence. It's okay to ask a question, and maybe there's not an answer right away. And that's the same, that parallel in the classroom. We don't need to always get this constant ask a question, get an answer. We're sending the messages of thinking and thinking together. And my daughter, Ariel, who it works in a completely different field, she said that in her field, they call it, let it get weird in their meetings, which I really love to think about that idea.
That's where so much beauty happens.
And that sometimes speaking isn't the thinking.
It strikes me as essential to being inspired by the Reggio approach that you do have thinking partners in your midst, locally or somewhere else, that you can think about some of these deeper concepts with. Do you have suggestions of how educators might be able to connect with other thinking partners if that's not something that their program offers them time to do?
Write to me. I think there's so many beautiful Facebook groups and things out there on social media, but be careful. There are so many things that are out there on the internet that are not accurate about this approach. I can't say to you, here's where you go to find a person. But what I can say to you is find a person, one person. It might be a teacher in your school. It might be somebody a million miles away who wants to think with you and find somebody to connect with around this. And it doesn't even have to always be an educator who listens and thinks with you. I will say that I'm so grateful for the educators that I have somehow managed to surround myself with all over the place, like you, like those of you who I'm thinking of right now. You know who you are. And if you think it's you, it is you. It's all of you. The people who really spark things in me, the people who share the stories from the classroom with me and allow me to poke at them and ask new questions. I think about, I don't have this quote exactly, but Malaguzzi said something like, keep your feet on the ground and your head in the clouds, or your head in the sky, meaning you're doing the work. You're doing the work on the ground, but you're also thinking all the time. It's just so multi-layered. And so this thinking you need to do with others. So it wasn't a perfect answer of where to find those people, but I promise you they exist.
Can you speak about some of the many myths there are about the Reggio Emilia approach that you might encounter when you're working with educators?
Anyone who is studying this approach has had myths that we've believed even for a little while. This is such a deep approach. We're always looking for where to grab on. And so often we grab on somewhere that we saw that feels maybe like tangible for us, but it may not really be a part of the approach. But I think the main myth is that this is just a curriculum. And so going back to that idea that this was a social movement, I think it really changes the way you see yourself in the classroom. So a friend of mine is a director, and she visited a school that said it was Reggio inspired. She was taken on a tour. And on the tour, the person walking her around kept pointing to things and saying, we Reggioized this and we Reggioized that. And
the verb.
As though it's a verb and that you can do that. Now, the people in Reggio would say, we are here in Reggio Emilia, the schools of Reggio Emilia. We have our context and who we are has come from that. You can't be us. You can't be Reggio. So instead of saying, I am Reggio, or our school is Reggio, that's why we're so careful to say Reggio inspired. Also, I tend to say I study the Reggio approach, and I do. But what they would say to you is, as I said before, know who you are. And when I say that, I mean, really figure out what are your values. What do you want for children in this world? What kind of humans, in From Teaching to Thinking, Ann Pelo and Marge Carter, they said, what kind of humans do we want in this world? And then plan your life, you're in the classroom around that. Constantly, that's what they would say to us, is match your practice to your values. There is no specific material that is part of the Reggio approach. It's not having a light table or having white walls or having natural materials. That is not what they would say. Now you are anointed as the Reggio approach. It is not that, but it is about thinking about what we want for the children. What kind of environment, what kind of conditions can we create that really spark children's thinking and learning and adults' thinking and learning and research? I've been studying this for a number of years now, but I'm constantly asking myself, what do I believe about children? When people talk about the image of the child as they do in Reggio Emilia, they're asking us to really dig into that, not just say, I believe children are capable. We can say that all day long. But what does it truly look like in a classroom if you believe that? And so it really asks us to look even farther. I'd like to just share another, I guess, myth in a sense. A lot of people, Lisa, you've probably heard people say, we follow the children's interests. And in Reggio, they might say something like that, that we're looking for what interests the child. But what they really mean is they're looking for what is meaningful and important. And so I tend to ask the question, what is important in your class? What's different about this year and these children and adults that are together? What feels important there? And when you figure that out, and hopefully it's a part of your daily life in the classroom, study it. So as an example, in a school where during the pandemic, they couldn't have the families coming in as they had always had before. So they developed this carpool where the families would drive up to the school and pick up the children. The children were obsessed with carpool all day long. What they would be discussing was, I wonder who's going to be first to be picked up. I wonder what car your dad's driving. I want, and that kind of wondering and thinking and dialoguing, that tells us move closer to this, pay attention. And as I tend to say to people, maybe even write down this sentence, what does it mean that dot, dot, dot. What does it mean that they're thinking about carpool? Is it really about the cars? Probably not. It probably is much more connected to the social and emotional aspect as the children are getting to understand themselves in the context of the world.
I just wrote down, what does it mean that? Dot, and dot. I'm picturing you, Sandy. I'm picturing you walking through a school and slightly loudly saying, study it.
Study that. Pay attention to this. Here it is right in front of you. It's so beautiful. Some classes that always go every day to the same tree. What does it mean that they're doing that? And really paying attention to the children's agenda and the children's thinking. But can I do one last one? I think that some people have the understanding or maybe the misunderstanding that the teacher's role is that I would say that we are the loose parts givers. That's it. We are here to offer loose parts and see what they do. But that's not what they are doing in Reggio Emilia at all. Yes, they have open-ended materials that they use, but they're there because they thought about something that happened before, what would ask a question to the children through those materials. And by the way, Naama would say to us, they would never refer to them as loose parts. I know I'm blowing all your minds right now. She said, there's nothing loose about them. Just so interesting, right? Language is so powerful. What we offer to children offers them a way to make visible their theories and thinking. So it's never just sticking stuff out on a table and saying, go for it. It's not that at all. If you offer something to the children, you're coming with a question that you're trying to answer for yourself. what does it mean that dot, dot, dot? And how can I offer some materials that might continue to ask the question and might help children be able to make their thinking visible?
I want to go back to how you spoke about looking for the unexpected, and that it's so much more interesting. And it strikes me as where we shouldn't ask a child a question that is obvious that we already know the answer to. What color are you using? For example, that's not what we're going for. And we already know the answer, and it's not exciting for the child, and it's rote knowledge. And so what, we're testing the rote knowledge.
This quote that sticks with me from Piaget, who said, "What is the goal of education? Are we forming children who are only capable of learning what is already known?" That's really frightening. The people that are changing the world are people that go beyond what is known. So why would we ever want to send the message to children to just learn what we know? That we are the keepers of all knowledge and we're here to transmit it.
When you have a group of children who's fascinated by that bird that keeps pecking at the window, and it happens every morning around the same time, and that catches their attention, yeah, it takes them away from the partner painting that you're trying to have them do at the easel. But there's something more important happening in their world, in their life, in their periphery, right under your nose. So it's our job to pick that up.
And for us to be the mirror and the highlighter of that thinking and the circulator. And in Reggio Emilia, they use this term circularity, that our job is to circulate the thinking of the children and the adults in the classroom, to really bring it forward in some way. Really is a shift, isn't it?
It is a shift. I would love to know, and I think your listeners would like to know also, what in your work brings you a sense of radical amazement, extreme joy?
I love the term radical amazement, by the way. It is hopefully how we try to live our lives, always trying to be amazed by things around us, and particularly the children. They show us the way. Amelia Gambetti, who was there with Malaguzzi, you know, early on, and shared on a previous podcast with us that Malaguzzi said this expression that maybe you've heard that comes from Reggio Emilia, nothing without joy. And she really changed my understanding of that when she said what Malaguzzi meant was that the joy comes from a huge effort. It's not about being happy all the time. It's about the effort, that because you always have to continue thinking. And she said, from my point of view, it keeps you alive. From a big effort, the joy multiplies. So really paying attention and trying and risk-taking and being present and living in it and asking ourselves questions. So I would say that quote in itself has a meaning so much deeper than I even imagined. But as far as what brings me joy, and in no particular order, I will say this podcast, doing this podcast brings me a lot of joy because it allows me to speak to these incredible heroes of mine, people that I've read about for years and years and years, and I can't even believe that they're willing to speak to me. I have learned so much by asking them questions and just hearing all their different perspectives. So thank you to all the guests from my podcast. I want to say one other thing that brings me joy. I can't really state enough that it is those educators, the educators around me that are constantly seeking, constantly trying to push themselves, that ask all kinds of amazing questions, that are tired sometimes, that it's, and it's hard all the time, but they really keep me on my toes. And I love that. That brings me so much joy. And I just wanted to give one example of when you talked about the unexpected, because that is the other thing that brings me so much joy, finding that those unexpected moments. And there's a teacher in Boulder, Colorado. Her name is Joni. She's an infant teacher. And she shared with me this beautiful story of her infants who at the beginning of the year were not mobile around the room. They couldn't move around the room, but by mid-year they could. She started paying so much attention to the fact that they started moving once they could to little areas in the room where they would essentially, she called it water cooler moments, that they would meet up in all different places. And she started paying attention and highlighting and documenting those meetups that children know about getting to know. They know about being a social being. They know many, many things, but we need to understand how they see that and how they see themselves. And that just gives me chills.
Sandy, your passion shouts through the screen and through our ears and is such a gift. I am sensing that two of your values are gratitude and learning.
I appreciate that you recognize that about me. I mean, there's so many awful things to know about me, but those for real are very much the truths. All of you, the people on the ground in those classrooms, you are activists. The marching that people do for causes, you are marching every day as you walk into your classroom. And you are changing the world. I'm really grateful to you for that. Lisa, I'm really grateful to you for doing this.
It's been such an honor, and I look forward to the next time. And thank you, Sandy.
If you would like to know more about my wonderful guests or the Reggio approach, please go to my website at sandylanesconsulting.com or find us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter.